Welcome back to the Like a Bigfoot podcast. I'm your host, Chris Ward. This is the story of the 1,000-mile Iditarod on skis. We're sitting down with Sunny Strar for the podcast. Sunny is an incredible adventurer. She's done all sorts of crazy things, from climbing some of the tallest mountains ever to putting on expeditions, leading people to taking on long, incredibly difficult trails. We spoke to Sunny on a previous episode, and she's one of the most inspirational and knowledgeable folks that I've been able to chat with for the podcast. So I'm incredibly excited to have her back on. Pair that with the fact that she just finished the Iditarod 1,000-mile trail, and she finished with an hour and 50-some minutes to spare. This story has it all. It's incredible. The weather was crazy. The ups and the downs from this experience is wild. So I'm very honored to share part of Sunny's story. We joke in the episode, like, she's distilling a month-long event down to like a 40-minute podcast, which I realize is kind of mildly ridiculous. But I, at the same time, I think she does a wonderful job telling the stories, talking about the ups and downs, talking about the challenges, talking about how she faced them, and you know, how she grew and what she learned about herself along the way. So this is an awesome episode. Thank you all for tuning in. Let's just jump right into it. This is the Like a Bigfoot podcast number 376 with Sunny Strar. All right, ladies and gentlemen, super honored once again to be joined by Sunny Strar. And Sunny, just, I mean, we'll get into this whole entire story, but you just completed the 1,000-mile Iditarod on skis. Absolutely incredible. You had an insane month of adventure, and I'm just psyched to hear all about it, Sunny. Welcome. Congrats, too, by the way.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thanks for having me. I got back from Alaska a week ago tomorrow. Is that right? Yeah, I got back. I was supposed to get back Thursday night, ended up getting home Friday. And so I'm still, you know, processing, trying to figure out what actually happened out there. I was in Alaska for over a month and on the trail for just under 30 days, like an hour and 54 minutes shy of 30 days, which I happen to know on the dot because 30 days is the cutoff for the race. So I barely managed to finish as an official finisher, but I did.
Wow. I know. That's the thing, like, as the last few days were approaching, just following your stories on Instagram, like, it had me on the edge of my seat, just being like, is she going to be able to make it? And we can get into it, but like, the weather had to cooperate and all of this stuff. It was intense.
And I know I stressed out a couple people probably more than I should have, like my husband, for example, because the very final stretch going into Nome, which is where the finish line was at about mile 950, you know, it's called the Iditarod 1000, but it's actually less than 1,000 miles. So, you know, going into the finish line, most other competitors who were still out there, which was only a handful, you know, there were two others kind of finishing within hours of me, but they decided to just push through the night and go straight through. And I was like, I don't need to push through the night. I'm going to go sleep. So I laid down and I slept because I like sleep. And then I had intended to get up at 2 a.m. to make sure that I was going to make it to the finish in time for the cutoff at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And, you know, my alarm rang at 2 and I'm like, I'm really comfortable. I'm going to hit snooze. Snooze for about 90 minutes. And I was like, okay, I better get up and better get going because I'm now actually at risk of timing out.
That's like the most relatable thing anyone's heard from like a high level athlete, you know, like, oh, high level athletes, they like snooze as well.
Oh, 100%.
But I think it's such a crazy thing to be doing this for a month and having it come down to the wire. Like, I mean, first of all, I think it takes a lot of really great planning strategies because, you know, if that was the strategy, obviously the weather caused all sorts of issues, but like, it made it so you were very well planned and well organized, where you were able to get it done right on time, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I got lucky in many ways, because if the weather had been worse than it was, there was a very real chance that I might not have been able to finish at all or within the cutoff. But I also knew going into this race, I mean, from the very start, I knew that I'm not a performance athlete, I'm an adventure athlete. And I also was just coming off a stress fracture, actually, that I'd sustained in late November, early December this past year. We had a couple of weeks really to try and physically prepare for this. So from the very beginning, my goal was not to try and go fast. My goal was to try and meter myself and do what I could just to set myself up to finish within the cutoff. Initially, I had a plan laid out that was going to have me finish 4 days sooner than I did. So I had four buffer days, and I used all of those four buffer days. The first buffer days I actually used within the first 300 miles, which was a bit nerve-wracking because, you know, that pace wasn't going to be sustainable. Of course, I was going to have to speed up, but yeah, all in all, I was trying to be strategic rather than try to go as fast as possible.
So I know that you have completed the 350 three previous times. And I think it was actually, it might have been right after we chatted the last time we did the podcast. You and your husband went out and did it on a bike. Can I hear about that really quick before we get into this one?
So that was super fun. That was my third time doing the Iditarod, the short distance, as you said, 350 miles. They call it 350 miles. It's actually 306 miles or so. So you see a pattern there. You know, the distances aren't quite as bad as they sound, but they're close enough. That was a really fun adventure because Paul, my husband, is not really an endurance athlete. He is a passionate and incredibly skilled and experienced big wall climber who's done big wall climbing expeditions all over the world, including lots and lots of ascents in Yosemite. But he's not an endurance athlete. So, you know, I'd gotten him into the race, I'd gotten him interested, and we decided to just want to do this together to finish, to tour essentially. And when you're on a fat bike, you know, as long as the trail is firm, it's much easier to cover 40 or 50 miles a day than it is to try and do that on foot or on skis. So we had a great time together. I actually made some bad mistakes. I got the most terrible saddle sores because I'm not a cyclist. I also had some real issues with my lungs because we had some incredibly cold temperatures and I didn't protect my airway properly. So for me, it was a hard year in some ways, but at the same time, you know, we took a complete rest day during that race and just enjoyed the landscape and enjoyed each other's company and still finished with about 2 days to spare to the cutoff.
Was that his first time in Alaska and in the wilderness of Alaska?
It wasn't his first time in Alaska. He actually did an early ascent off the south face of Denali via a route that's very rarely done, the Haston-Scott route. That was back in, I think, 1985 or something. And he's done a bunch of climbing in the Ruth Gorge and, you know, has been up there quite a bit. But it was his first time being in Alaska in the winter, his first time seeing the Northern Lights, and it was his very first ultra marathon. He'd never done an ultra up until that race.
That's amazing. That is so cool. Like, yeah, I know. I'm just wondering, like, when you get to the finish of that together, like, when do you mention the idea of like, hey, I think I'm gonna try to do the 1,000 mile version of this?
Well, he knew that I had an interest in it because the entire time when we had signed up together, we actually had kind of come up with a strategy because neither one of us was sure that he was going to be able to physically sustain the preparation and the training to show up at the start line for the 350. So even that first year that we, or my third year, his first year that we did the 350 together, I actually had signed up for the 1,000 and he signed up for the 350. And we decided that if his preparation was going well, I was going to drop down to the 350 and do it together with him because we didn't want, you know, my 1,000 preparation to kind of overshadow or taint the experience that we were going to have together during the 350. But he always knew that I had an interest in the 1,000. And as soon as we finished, you know, he promised he was never going to do it again and then promptly signed up for the 350 again. And I knew that I wanted to try and become one of the first people to ski to Nome. And that's exactly what I did.
That's amazing. Wait, so he did the 350 this year?
He signed up again and he trained for it and started, and he ended up scratching at mile 120 because of some really bad conditions and a scary that was not what he was looking for.
No. I mean, following along, like, the conditions this year just seemed so wild and so just like boomeranging back and forth with temperatures and all that. It's crazy. Can I just shout out real quick? There was a couple of previous guests who also did the 1,000, which is crazy. And as a po as the pot like as a podcast host, I'm like, I was proud. I don't know why. I was just like, wait a second. There are three people I've interviewed who are doing the 1,000-mile Iditarod. What
That's
a
rad.
weird world. So Ryan Wanless, it was his third 1,000-miler. Insane. Coolest guy. Best guy ever. I love that guy.
And he's been a fantastic mentor to me, by the way. He's helped me with so many things and, was on the phone with me trying to talk me through the course a couple of days prior to race start and all of those things. So, yeah, I love Ryan.
He's the best. Like, he's the nicest. Like, I think probably like a third of the guests that I've had on the show have somehow been because of Ryan Wanless. Like,
I love it.
he's the best. And then Gavin Hennigan, who won it on foot, who I've stood by, like, whenever people have asked, like, what are some of my favorite episodes, I always mention one with Gavin because he is just the most interesting man in the world.
Super cool. Yeah, and I
Yeah.
don't know Gavin as well, but he was incredibly kind. He sent me a message a couple of days before the finish after he had crossed the finish line already, when I was going through the whole, oh, the weather is bad. We're not sure
Yeah.
if we're going to be able to pass and whatnot. And he sent me a really encouraging message on my GPS, so that was really sweet of him.
Oh, that's sweet. And then last but certainly not least, Carol Sepelu, who lives in Nome, and she
Nice.
greets everybody. And I told her, I sent her this message. I was with my nephews, and they were just Iditarod nerding out for some reason, like they were learning about it in school or something. And I was like, dude, I was like, dudes, get over here. And I was like, there's this awesome person, this athlete that I interviewed for the podcast who lives there, and she's posting videos of all the finishers. So we like just flipped through and watched all the people finishing the Iditarod, and they loved it. So,
Awesome.
anyways, it's just, it seems like such a cool community. And it takes a certain type of person to be able to even want to show up at the start line. Can you kind of like describe the community?
It's magical, to be honest, and it's what's keeping me coming back year after year after year. I already reached out to the race director for this coming year. I'm not going to be racing because, it's expensive and it's a lot of time, but
Yeah.
I'm committed to volunteering and I'm really excited to being back up there in a different capacity. So, yeah, the people are amazing. Of course, it's a self-selective crowd, right? Somebody who wants to put themselves out there, wants to be that uncomfortable, wants to challenge themselves, no matter if that's for the 350 or for the 1000. And around the race, the volunteers and the communities that we pass through, I mean, it's
Yeah.
just amazing to see the cheer and the support and how everybody's coming together, for us. And when I say us, it's kind of the back of the field, the last couple of folks that straggled to the finish line. We had a section where the trail was buried under fresh, wet snow, and the mayor of the community, the village that we had just passed through, heard about it and came out at 9:30 p.m. on his snow machine, the mayor in person, to go and cut trail for us so that we could pass the next morning. So, stuff like that is just really cool.
That's amazing. And I can just tell, like, when you're telling the story, like, it's just one of those like small acts of kindness that just mean so much. And it's probably more meaningful to you all than even the guy thought it would be, you know?
And it's not a small act of kindness because travel out there is dangerous. You
Yeah.
don't really go and move between villages unless you have to, and definitely not at 9:30 p.m. As it's getting dark. And he was just like, yeah, I don't want you guys to be stuck. And he knew that if there was no trail, we were all going to be timing out. And he just came out and put trail in.
That's so cool. That's so cool. Can you like just kind of walk us through the whole story? Like, I just kind of want to just sit here and just listen to like what it was like. And obviously it's over a month, and you know, it's being distilled down to like a 45-minute to an hour-long podcast, which is kind of silly, I understand. But can you kind of like just, I don't know, tell me what it was like, 'cause I've always imagined the Iditarod as the premier, and Alaska just in general, in my mind, I'm always like, it's the premier adventure place. Like, if I think of what an adventure is to like what I always thought growing up, it was Alaska. It had to have been Alaska. And it seems like such a wild place.
It's definitely a wild place and it is a wild adventure. And it is really difficult to distill the Iditarod into
Yeah.
a coherent story, right? Because it is so vast and so enormous. And actually, I really haven't processed yet.
Yeah.
Actually, I haven't shared anything on my personal social except for a couple of snippets and stories because I'm like, I don't even know where to start. I have
Yeah.
so many stories and so much material I was filming out there. I, did a lot of photography, but I just don't even know where to begin. So maybe let me try to take you through the topography a little bit and,
Okay.
share stories along with that because the race changes radically over the course of those 950 miles. You start pretty close to Anchorage, and you know, you go through an area kind of leading up, going west towards the Alaska Range, where you're along the Yentna River, and you have private like log cabins, and you have roadhouses, and you have snow machine traffic, and you have, you know, a bunch of racers, because many more people do the 350 mile distance than the 1,000 distance, and we share that first part of the course, right? So for the first like 150 miles or so, you're just kind of gradually, you know, moving towards the Alaska Range, and it feels remote, but it still feels pretty manageable. You know, there's no roads, but as I said, you see people, you see snow machiners coming through, you know, every like dozen miles or so, you can probably get indoors if you really needed to. And it's just kind of a cool taste to be skiing along the frozen Yentna River and then onto the Squintna and then starting to go into the foothills. And you're like, oh, I'm getting more and more remote, right? And this is starting to be exciting. So
It's like a gradual, like, it's gradual into the remoteness, it sounds like.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, anywhere here in the lower 48, you get to a trailhead, you start hiking, and yeah, you know, you're away from pavement and you're already feeling remote, but you're like, yeah, you know, if I needed to, I could get out relatively quickly. And then the longer you spend, the more you're like, oh no, I can't get out. Like, this is committing. So, you know, that's the first 150 miles. And for what it's worth, since I'd done the 350 three times before, I was kind of thinking, okay, the first part is just me getting to the Alaska Range and then across the Alaska Range and getting to the 350 finish line. That shouldn't be too hard. You know, I've done it before. So I also know that happiness equals reality minus expectations, right? And I kind of know that typically any big adventure delivers the exact opposite of what you're expecting. So I was a little worried looking at the 350 as just like, yeah, casual, you know, I've done it before, and then getting my butt kicked by it because I wasn't taking it seriously enough. And in some ways, that's exactly what happened. We had some really bad weather, incredibly high winds and a big storm, cold temperatures on day three, I think. And that's where my husband ended up deciding to scratch. I kept pushing through, but I was already a day behind my intended schedule at that point. And, you know, I was pushing pretty hard, pretty low on calories, and like struggling trying to keep up. And then I approached the Alaska Range. And in some ways, you know, the Alaska Range is the high point of the course. So in general, most of the 950 miles are pretty low down. You don't go any higher than, I think, Rainy Pass is at like 3,300 feet or so. So, you know, it's low elevation. Most of it is near sea level. You have a couple of rolling hills and whatnot, but the elevation change isn't like crazy. But you do have that climb up and over the Alaska Range, going through Rainy Pass. And that's a dreaded segment because the weather in Rainy Pass can be incredibly challenging. And as I was slowly approaching, you know, the start of Rainy Pass, in some ways it was actually really fortuitous that I was already behind schedule because the weather had been terrible on pass. And me being a little bit slower allowed me to let the worst of the weather pass and then push through in a window that still wasn't ideal. You know, the weather was still rough. The wind chill forecast the day that I went across was negative 50 degrees. So, you know, pretty full on. But it wasn't as bad as it had been the day previously. But I also at this point didn't have the luxury anymore to wait for another day because I was actually already coming close to the cutoffs, right? So I'm pushing through now. I'm going across the pass. It was hard. It was really windy. I ended up cresting the pass right before nightfall, and it was already getting dark. And the entire time, because it was so cold and because it was so windy, I had allowed myself to fall behind on calories a little bit because, you know, in order to eat, you have to stop, you have to take your gloves off, you have to, you know, you stop moving, you get exposed. Like, it's just not good. So I decided to make a trade-off and to say, I'm just not going to eat as much as I know I should. I'm going to push across the pass. And once I'm across the pass and I'm a little bit out of the worst of the wind, I'm going to put my, you know, really big down jacket on. And then I'm going to, you know, really catch up on the calories and try to push to the next aid station. Well, I got across the pass and I was very cold and very low on calories at this point. You know, I'd worn all my other layers, like all my Gore-Tex and my mid layer and everything, but I hadn't yet put on the big down jacket. And I opened up my pack to put on my big down jacket, and I realized that I didn't have my big down jacket in my pack. I had left it behind inadvertently at the last checkpoint before the pass.
No way.
So at this point, you know, I'm really cold, I'm really depleted, I still have 12 miles to go to the next checkpoint. It's dark.
Yeah.
I know that further I descend into what's called the Dalzell Gorge. It's this really beautiful wild section of the course that has, you know, a narrow gorge with a river running through it. I knew that that's an area that typically is really cold because the cold air kind of sinks to the bottom. And I didn't have enough calories to keep myself warm through movement, right? So I'm like, okay, and I don't have another layer to put on at this point. So I'm like, what do I do? That was a really big mistake that I made. I'm like, I think the race is over. You know, I'm going to hunker down right now where I am, and I'm going to get in my sleeping bag and sleep because I need to get warm. I need to get calories. I need to rest, and then I can deal with everything else. But I don't think that I can now finish the race because I was just a couple hours away from the cutoffs and I needed my down jacket without a question, you know?
Yeah.
And okay, that was the stupidest thing, but what do you do? Right. So I went to sleep. I was certain that my race was over, and I was able, though, via GPS to get in touch with Steve, who is the owner of the Rainy Pass Lodge, which is where the last checkpoint was. And they found my jacket and they found snow machiners who were traveling, you know, my
direction. No way. Yeah.
And they were able to send my jacket with the snow machiners. So, you know, at this point, I'm waking up still 12 miles from the next checkpoint where there's a cutoff coming up, right? And I'm still not entirely sure what's happening with my jacket. You know, should I just like go back to Rainy Pass Lodge where my jacket is and where it's much cheaper to fly out from, by the way, because if you scratch from the race, you're responsible for your own costs to fly back to civilization. Yeah. And it was like going back to Rainy Pass, it was going to cost me about $800 to fly out. And I was going to have my jacket. Going forward to Roan was closer, but it was going to cost me $2,500 to fly out, you know, and my jacket.
Yeah.
So I was like, what do I do? But in the end, I kind of went with gravity and I went forward towards the next aid station at 12 miles and made it with, I think, 50 minutes to spare before the cutoff for that aid station. And then said, okay, I'm just going to regroup here, take a good big break, see if my jacket actually makes it to me, and then think about what happens. And sure enough, you know, my jacket got delivered by a bunch of very generous snowboarders. And I rested for most of the day because I only had 12 miles of skiing to do by virtue of kind of my screwed up schedule, right?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I still have time to make it to the short finish line. I'm still within the cutoffs. There's no reason for me to drop. But, you know, I've now already burned through two of my buffer days because one of those buffer days was the unplanned bivvy. And another buffer day was the bad weather, you know, down below Rainy Pass.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
So, yeah,
let me ask you this, because you've done a whole bunch of stuff in the desert. We talked about Hey Duke Trail and all that stuff, right? So, you know, when you're in the desert and it's like really hot, the sun's beating down on you, but you have an extra bottle of water in your bag and you're like, in your brain, you're like, I know I have that extra bottle. And it's this weird, like, I don't know, it's like a parachute. You're like, I know, I'll be good. I have the extra bottle. But then you drink the extra bottle and then you're like, oh shit. Like, now I don't have anything. Is having like a down jacket, like you were talking about having all these other layers on, but you know, like you have a down jacket. Like, I haven't put my down jacket on yet. So I know I can at least get warmer. But like, once you put that on and it's still cold in like a area like this, is it kind of like a similar feeling where you're like,
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I did have that happen a couple times later on in the course because, you know, the day that I crossed Rainy Pass, I think it, where I slept, it ended up being like negative 42 or so. And, you know, who knows, maybe on the pass it was negative 50, I'm not sure, but I had really good like weather and windproof gear on and I was moving and I was exerting myself, right? And so I was kind of staying warm that way, but I let myself decline more than I would have if I hadn't had the safety net of the down jacket.
Yeah.
Now, there were two or three other mornings later on in the race going up towards the Yukon River region where it was just so brutally cold. And I have no idea what the temperatures were because I didn't carry a thermometer at the time. But I was wearing everything I had, including that big down jacket, including a down blanket that I was using around my lower body. And I was, you know, well fed. I had calories in my system. I was moving at a good clip and I was still really cold.
Wow.
So those moments were like...
How do you not panic in moments like that? Because you're way out there. You mentioned like you're by after a while, like to get you out would be like a big, like it's not, it wouldn't be easy.
It's It's difficult. I mean, in some ways, there is still that mental backstop of, well, I have my sleeping bag, right?
Yeah,
If
you
things
still
get
got one
really
more thing.
bad, and that's what I did in rainy past. If things get really bad, I'll
Yeah.
stop. I'll get into my sleeping bag. That's negative 40 degrees. And, now if you're wet because, of precipitation or because you've been sweating, then that is yet another issue. But in general, there is still that one more backstop. But
Yeah.
I did have, one of those really cold moments in a section that was leading up to Ruby, which is about mile 500. And it's actually one of the cruxes of the course because between McGrath, which is the finish line for the short distance, and mile 306, all the way to mile 495 Ruby, there really aren't any villages. And there's no, well, there's a couple of villages in like the first 40 miles, but that doesn't help you. You're fresh out of McGrath. And then there's this 150 mile stretch where there's nothing. There are a couple of public shelter cabins, but they're not heated unless you can find wood, right? And then there is a couple of like structures that the Iditarod dog sled race uses. But by the time I came through there, there was nobody there. There was no heat. It was just, again,
Yeah.
not really an opportunity to warm up. So I had one of those really cold nights exactly in that spot where there's nothing and I saw no people and I had no opportunity whatsoever to either get indoors or to hope that, somebody would pass by and potentially be able to assist. And I thought in that moment that even though my motivation for doing the ITI initially was that I think I'd like to ski to the South Pole, I was like, you know what? Maybe I don't want to ski to the South Pole because out
Yeah.
there you've got nothing. You have
Yeah.
no indoor opportunities for 712 miles if you do the Hercules Inlet route.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, is that the most remote section of the whole course?
I think so. Yeah, you
Yeah.
have that section, between the ghost town of Ophir and Ruby. That's about 100 and, yeah, more than 150 miles of no like populated indoor, no heated indoor access. There are two shelter cabins, but as I said, you have to, be able to cut wood in order to heat those up.
So I wanted to ask you this just about the remoteness. You've done things all around the world and you've guided up these giant mountains and all of this. Where have you felt the most remote? Because there's, being on top of a giant mountain like you have, I have to imagine, you feel pretty darn remote up there. But being in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness is another thing. Like, I don't know. Do you even think about that, or is it more like remote is remote?
I do think about that, and I did feel very remote in that stretch that we were just talking about. I mean, that
Yeah.
was definitely up there. Another moment that comes to mind was actually here locally, in the Grand Canyon. I did a fastest known time a couple of years ago with a friend called the Tuck Up Trail, which is on the Esplanade level. So that's like halfway between the rim and the river. And
Okay.
it's roughly an 80-mile route that just snakes along the Esplanade and running all of these canyons. And in theory, you're not that far away from civilization. You're like, I don't know, probably 3 miles out from the closest dirt road and, 50 miles out from the closest town. But because you're on that middle level, you can't get anywhere. You can't easily get to the rim and you can't get down to the river where there's rafters. And so you're right there, but you're just not accessible. So helicopters are a bit easier in that section, not that you can
Yeah.
count on that. But yeah, that's another one that comes
But
to mind.
still, wow, that is wild. That is so where's the Yukon River in all this? 'Cause I know there's a big section just from a few years ago we followed Ryan's dot with my students, and I just remember him on that river for forever, it seemed like. So.
Yeah, so the Yukon is huge. And one thing that you probably know about the Iditarod, since you cover this in school, is you have a northern and a southern route. And the routes kind of trade off in even and uneven years. We
Okay.
were on the northern route this year. And the reason that this is important is because the Yukon kind of comes into play at different lengths and different times, depending on which route you're on. So we were on the northern route this year. And that means that the Yukon started at around mile 500 at Ruby, which is the spot that I was just talking about. And then you had about 135 miles of travel along the Yukon until, and that just kind of goes from east to west until you exit the Yukon and go overland on the historic Keltac Portage Trail to the coast. And that kind of section is a 70 to 80 mile section that connects the Yukon, which is at the Baskin communities and villages, with the Inuit villages on the coast. So it's a really important trade route.
Yeah. I know before we get to the coastal stuff, I know that a lot of the fascination with this for people who just hearing about the Iditarod is the wildlife that you're running into. And I'm pretty sure I read one of your posts and you said you saw Wolverine.
I did.
And all
Yeah.
I was like, I just was like, that's badass. That was my only thought. So it wasn't like a deep thought necessarily, but I'm like, oh, Wolverine, that's badass. Like, what was
So
that whole experience?
I have to admit, so I'm not a US citizen, right? I didn't grow up in the US. English is not my first language. And when I got introduced to Wolverines in my teenage years, this was like, Wolverine, the character from
X-Men.
what's the X-Men, exactly. So I didn't even know that Wolverines were an actual thing. They certainly do not exist in Germany. And
I'm gonna
when
call. Can I call my wife out really quick? Because what I can't remember what we were doing, but I was like, yeah, like I might have even said it after I saw that post. I was like, she saw Wolverine, and my wife's like, those are real. And so, yeah, same thing.
Exactly. I didn't know that they were real until I did the ITI and somebody was talking about Wolverines. I'm like, wait, they're real? So I looked them up. I'm like, oh, they're an actual thing. So that's something that I learned relatively recently. But yeah, I saw one actually in the coastal section. And it was amazing because I'd been skiing all day. The winds were really high. It was going on dusk. And, because I'd been out there for so long, not just that day, but the entire trip, my vision wasn't great, between all of the wind and the whiteout conditions and the cold. And I wear contact lenses and just the fatigue. I had pretty blurry vision. And I was traveling by myself, which I did for 99% of this effort. And I was looking up ahead and I saw this creature kind of, walk across the trail very leisurely, probably 50 yards, down trail. And I was downwind from it. So it hadn't smelled me, it hadn't seen me, it hadn't heard me because the wind was pretty loud. And I couldn't tell what it was. I'm like, it's too small for a bear. It doesn't look like a wolf, wrong color. Like, what is this thing? Is it like a cat? That's really weirdly colored. I couldn't tell. And so rather than getting my phone out to try and take video or photo, I yelled because I wasn't sure if it would be hostile. And I wanted to make sure that, it knew that I was there. And it heard my yell and looked up and kind of started loping away. And between the tail and the movement, I'm like, oh, that's a Wolverine. This is so cool. So yeah, it was
You're
pretty
like,
wild.
it's the most hostile animal.
I mean, it is, though they're not typically hostile to humans, from what I understand, unless you surprise them, which.
That's awesome. That's super cool. Any other memorable kind of animal encounters? Or like, I just remember a few years ago, the moose were a huge issue. Did that happen this year, or was it not as bad?
Moose are always an issue, not for me personally, thankfully. We did have two racers who had issues with them. And in the Iditarod, dog race, there was an issue as
Oh,
well. Vitaly, actually the champion, ended up having to kill a moose. I don't know if you saw the
I
memes
did
about
hear about that.
that. Yeah, but I got lucky. I didn't see a single one, and I'm very happy with that.
Moose are intimidating. People ask me, like, out in Colorado, they're like, what animals are you scared to run into when you're running? I'm like, moose, hands down. It's moose and rattlesnakes. Those are the scariest ones.
Absolutely. Moose
But
are
they'll
terrifying.
charge you. If you round the corner and you surprise it, they'll charge you no problem. And they're giant animals. So I'm like, yeah, terrifying.
Yep, I agree.
But so you get with like what at what point do you get to the ocean and the sea ice and all that? Like, how far into the race is that?
Yeah, so, still kind of fixated on that whole Ruby area because that's the start of the Yukon. That's mile 500. And then you have 135 miles along the Yukon. And then you have about 70, 80 miles overland to get to the coast. So you're looking at reaching the coast at around mile 700, 710 or so. And then you travel along the coast. And then actually, you have a section that's pretty exciting around mile 750 or so, where you go across the Norton Sound. So at that point, for about 40 miles, you have a section that goes across the sea ice. It's a trail that obviously only exists in the winter, at least for human power travel. In the summer, I guess you could try to swim it, but that'd be a little daunting. But you'd have to go by boat. So yeah, you go across the Norton Sound, and then once you're across the Norton Sound, you're at roughly mile 800. And you're then traveling again east-west along the coast all the way to Nome.
Is it intimidating to go across the sea ice, or I don't know, I guess at what point too are you just kind of in the flow and in the robot mode of just wake up, go to sleep, like that kind of thing?
I wasn't sure about the sea ice just because I had zero prior experience with it. And then you actually cross a couple of very short sections of sea ice even before the big Norton Sound crossing. You have a couple of ice sections going into the towns of Unalakleet and Shaktulik, which are the villages right before the Norton Sound. And I had a really scary moment on one of those ice sections where not only was I on the sea ice, I was on actual glare ice, because skiing on the sea ice doesn't necessarily mean that it's ice. You know, you're skiing on ice the entire time that you're on the Yukon as well, right? But it's covered in snow. And so the trail consistency can be very friendly, but you know that the surface underneath you is just a frozen river or frozen ocean. So that in and of itself isn't that scary. What was scary going into Shaktulik was that there was a section that was blown clear of snow. And so it was glare ice. It was dark. This was actually right after I saw the Wolverine, and or like 3 hours later. So it's dark, it's glare ice, and there was a really strong tailwind. And I'm on skis, right? And I was expecting that as soon as I hit the glare ice that I would speed up, but I had no concept of just how much I would accelerate. And the wind just grabbed me and pushed me with no control. You know, all that I could do was point my skis in the direction that I kind of wanted to go, which in and of itself was nerve-wracking because I saw one trail marker, but then the trail kind of made it, this little turn, and I didn't see that to start with. So my skis are pointing towards the last trail marker that I saw, and then I didn't see any markers anymore, and it's dark, right? And I have no idea like where the open ocean is and where this is taking me. So it was really unnerving. And then I was just going so fast. My sled overtook me, kind of like a slingshot, you know, and accelerated me even more. And I just couldn't do anything. I mean, I couldn't stop, I couldn't slow down. And so I was trying to stay upright and eventually crashed though, because, the ice is not uniform. Like it had bumps and like snowy ridges and pressure ridges and whatnot. So I cratered and even after falling, didn't come to a stop because the wind was so strong. It was still like ragdolling me across the ice. So that was really scary.
That
That
sounds
was,
terrifying.
yeah, that was the scariest moment in the entire race, I think. And it was the day before I had to cross the sea ice. And so I didn't know if sea ice meant glare ice or if it just meant snow on top of, frozen over ocean. Turns out that thankfully it was snow on top of, frozen ocean. So it wasn't that big a deal. But what was a big deal was that the sea ice crossing is a temporary trail, right? It breaks up every spring. And since I was one of the slower racers, I was coming very close to that breakup period. And we'd had some very wet, warm, and windy weather, which is typically when either breakup starts or, the ice floods from open water that gets pushed onto the ice. So it wasn't clear whether or not the sound was still going to be passable for me and the other folk that had to get across that day. And that was a little nerve-wracking.
That is, yeah, especially because it's like, how do you find out if it's passable? It's like, oh, go out and see if you can pass it. You know, like
Exactly.
it's not like someone's reporting on it for you. You all are figuring out for yourselves.
And, at the farthest point, you're about 15 miles any direction from land. So if you're out there while it's flooding, 15 miles, I was traveling about 2.5 to 3 miles an hour. So that's between 5 and 7 hours to get to land. So that's not great. And for what it's worth, the crossing ended up being mostly mellow. I did have two small flooded sections, but one of them was actually before I even hit the real sea ice. It was kind of on land still. And then the other one was right before the village that's at the far end of the Sound crossing. I mean, it was literally like at the village
You could
entrance. It was
see
just
it,
a big lake that had, opened up right before you go up the coast to access the village. But one of the skiers who had arrived about 6 or 7 hours before me did not have that lake. Like he just skied straight up onto dry land. And then by the time I got there, I'm wading like knee deep, right? And that had just happened within a couple of hours.
What was there anyone behind you?
And no, I was the last person.
Okay, I was wondering what their
Yeah.
experiences were like. Wow, that
There
is
were
wild.
two folks that came in within, maybe 2 or 3 hours before me, and they both had to wait as well.
Oh my gosh. Well, you mentioned the idea of like wet and rainy and warmer conditions, and you know, I'm sure you'll talk to some folks after doing this where they're like, oh, it was warmer on the Iditarod. That must have been such a good thing for you. You probably really, that would be make it easier. And you're on skis, so wet, slushy snow is terrible,
Yeah.
and that makes it way harder. Can you talk about that? Because I know that was kind of like the drama towards the end was is the snow going to be good enough?
Yeah. So there were a couple of issues with wet, warm precipitation, which we had. One of them was that one day it was literally, I think, 36, 37 degrees and raining and sleeting, right? And now at this point, it's really difficult to stay dry. And actually one of the most hypothermia-inducing conditions that you can find out there is in the 30s and wet, right? Because moisture conducts heat about 25 times faster than air. So if you're wet, you get cold that much more easily. So that's actually a really dangerous kind of environment to be out in. And it's very, very difficult, even with good Gore-Tex and good shells, to stay dry underneath in conditions like that. So that was one problem. And then the other problem was that the snow was getting super saturated. And, you know, at this point, we have this really wet, slushy, heavy snow where even with skis, I was punching in, you know, probably to the middle of my calf. And it's just really hard to make forward progress in that. Yeah. So that was really difficult. And then there was another day, actually the day leading up right to the finish before my final sleep, where thankfully it wasn't raining and slushing anymore. But it was again, like, you know, 32, 33 degrees, 34 degrees and dry. But the temperatures were so warm that my skis were icing up. And now, you know, I'm collecting snow on the bottom of my skis.
Yeah.
And it's just like crampons that are balling up. You know, you can't ski if you have snow on the bottom of your skis. Like, it's like you're Velcroing with every, like, there's no glide. Yeah. Right. So I ended up having to walk for a whole 20 miles because I just didn't have skiable conditions.
Wow. Wow. Well, I know that just from following Ryan's story too with the bike, he ended up having to walk like an insane amount towards those last few days just to get in and finish it, you know? Yeah. What can you describe, like, so you and a few racers are in a cabin waiting to figure out if it's even going to be possible. And you're so close. That's the thing. Like, you're so close to the finish line. You've been doing this for almost a month. Like, what's that cabin like? And, you know, what's the conversations and how is everyone feeling?
Yeah. So this was interesting because there were a total of five of us.
Okay.
Six. And, it had been me and Peter, two skiers who were kind of bringing up the very rear. And then there were Brandon, Mark, Kendra, and Josh, who were about a day ahead of us, between half a day and a day ahead of us. And so, you know, I had spent a night in a cabin with Peter in those atrocious conditions. And then Peter had gone on ahead. He was moving a little bit faster than me. He was getting up earlier. And I was in GPS communication with Josh, who was the skier, you know, on the party of four that was half a day ahead of us. And Joshua was the one who was up in the next cabin saying, just try to break trail. You know, it's physically impossible. I had to turn around. There's another guy who tried to break trail. It's physically impossible. We can't do it. Like, this may be it. We may not be able to get through. And I got the message from Josh. And in some ways I was like, you got to be kidding me, right? But in other ways I was looking at it and I was like, listen, you know, a trail like this and an adventure like this, it's all about just rolling with the punches and problem solving. And this was the tail end of a very, very warm day. And the forecast for the coming night and the following day was a lot colder. So I was like, listen, Josh, you know, deep breath, take a rest, great work. It's supposed to get colder. Things may freeze. If they freeze, we may have, you know, safe passage. Plus, Peter and I are half a day behind you. We can catch up to you if you can't move on. And with three skiers, you know, trail breaking is by far the easiest for skis. With a bike, you can't. On foot, it's really, really difficult. So with three skiers, I was like, we may have a chance to break trail ourselves if we share the load between the three of us. Yeah. So, you know, we talked about that. And then I actually jokingly kind of sent him a message being like, hey, you know, any snow machiners who might be able to go and help us out? And sure enough, he knew some snow machiners who knew the mayor who ended up coming out and helping, you know. So
awesome. In
some ways, I didn't have any live conversations at the time, but, you know, the GPS back and forth was just a matter of deep breath. Let's figure it out. And I was actually almost thinking it could be a relief to be able to stop without it being my fault.
You almost let those thoughts in. Almost. Yeah. And then you're like, go away, thoughts. When did you know you were actually going to finish it? Like, when was it no longer in doubt? Was it like right up to the end?
I think I knew. Well, I had a good feeling about it right after the Norton Sound crossing. So before that impassable section.
Okay.
starting at mile 800, I looked at it and I'm like, I think it's possible unless things completely turn south, which, you know, they
Got
kind of did.
close.
So there's
It
that.
got close.
But then I think when we'd gotten through the impassable section and I got to White Mountain, which is at mile 880, so about 70 miles from the finish. And from there, it was going to be 2 or 3 days to the finish. I still had the time. There was really bad weather yet again. It was a windstorm going through the section called the Topcock Hills, where actually a number of mushers had to get rescued in 2022 because the conditions were really bad.
Yeah.
And the person that we're staying with in White Mountain happened to be the team leader of the White Mountain Search and Rescue team that orchestrated the rescue of those dog teams 2 years prior, right? So we're talking about conditions, and he's all like, well, it's looking rough out there. You know, the winds are really bad. Not sure what you're going to do. Like, the storm is pretty bad. And I was like, yeah, but it's not as bad as 2 years ago, right? And he's like, no, I think it's exactly as bad as 2 years ago.
He's like, this is the same. It's
Yeah,
basically the same. Yeah.
exactly. So that still gave me pause. But I and everybody else decided to push out anyway and try to see if we could make it to the Topcock shelter cabin, which is where those dogs had needed the rescue, dogs and mushers. And when we got to that cabin, which was past the hilly section and kind of past some of the worst of the wind, I think that's when I knew that it was going to be possible.
That you're gonna get, yeah. So what's it like rolling into Nome? Nome seems like it seems like a magical place when you hear about it. It seems like a legendary town, and maybe it's obvious. I mean, it's obviously it's because of its connection with this event and this race. But yeah, what was that like?
It is legendary. It was really weird because there, were roads starting a couple miles outside of town, and a lot of those roads weren't cleared, right? And you're still
Yeah.
skating the same snow conditions as what you had before, but now all of a sudden you have street signs and speed limits. I had this 55 mile an hour speed limit, and I'm like, well, thank you for telling me that. Don't worry, wasn't gonna break it. But anyway, so it was a little jarring almost to get back to civilization because, there were more and more like cabins and houses, and then there were people. There were
Yeah.
people in trucks and snow plows and road clearing and, all of these things. And then there was a subway about 3/4 of a mile before the finish line, and I was starving, even though Ryan, the 350 mile foot finisher, a foot champion who lives in Nome and teaches
Yeah.
there, he actually come out to the end of the road and run me a burrito about 5 miles from the finish, right? So that was awesome. But I was still really hungry, and I'm like, hi, I still got an hour, maybe I should go back into the subway and get some food.
How do people expect to finish the one of the hardest things you can possibly do? It's like, I'm gonna take my time at a Subway.
I read my dot. Ed, what was also really
You
funny.
could have got total advertisements though. Like Subway would have paid big money for that story, you know?
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Well, so right before I saw the subway, I actually saw the race director who had rented an Airbnb that was right on Front Street, which is, kind of the road right by the ocean that the course finishes on.
Yeah.
And he had rented an Airbnb with a window going out on Front Street about a mile from the finish. So I didn't know that. I didn't expect it. And, all of a sudden I see this person poking his head out the window being like, Sonny, could you have taken any longer? And I'm like, I mean, maybe.
Got hour
So
and 50 minutes to spare. No big deal.
exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then folks from Nome were just they were awesome. A lot of people honking and cheering and being like, oh my God, congratulations, you're doing
Yeah.
it, you're almost there, so that was great.
That's so cool. So, what's going like? I know you said you probably haven't had a lot of time to process it. So, apologies for this question, but is there any big major thing that that I guess the way I think about it is if you do an event like this, you're obviously going to be a different person by the end than you were at the start. Have you even thought about that yet? Like what how you've changed or how you've grown?
That's a great question. And in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. I was really interested to see, how close I came to the edge of my personal risk tolerance,
Yeah.
because there were a number of times where I was like, I'm not safe. This is dangerous and I don't like it and I don't feel like I'm in control. And that's always my big thing. I do things that are far out and remote, but in general, I like minimizing objective hazard, and I picked the Iditarod and the South Pole actually because I feel like the objective hazard is mostly manageable by the individual, and I found that to not always be the case in this race. So that was an important learning. The other learning that's an indirect answer to your question is, early on when my husband Paul scratched from the 350-mile race and when other people decided to not move on beyond McGrath, beyond the finish line, even though they didn't sign up for the 1,000 and they didn't miss the cutoffs, I was thinking about what I should do because I knew I was cutting it close to the cutoffs already and I was going to have to chase cutoffs for the next, 3 weeks. And I thought about what I would do with the time that I might get back if I were to drop from the race at that point. And it was super clear for me. It was like, I don't want that time back. I want to be on the trail. I want to have these experiences. I have so much discovery and learning to do out there. I want that experience. And I'm so curious to see what will happen. And that persisted for, I think more than 50% of the second segment there, the second 600 miles. But it got to a point towards the end where I was like, okay, I feel like I have learned what I needed to learn. I'm not sure what it is that I learned, but at this point, I would be okay if I wasn't doing this anymore. Right. So I kind of had that perspective shift over time.
No, that's interesting. Like what feeds your soul as you're doing it? Because it's a month long. Like, it's not going to be the same thing throughout, you know?
In the beginning, curiosity and then commitment in some ways. I said that I wanted to do it. So, I have no reason to drop out. And actually, I told you that in some ways I was a little bit relieved when it sounded like the trail was impassable because I was like, oh, maybe I have an honorable way to not have to push hard anymore tomorrow. And then it turns out, no, you still have to push hard for another 5 days. But so commitment and follow through. Just not having a good reason to give up. I got frostbite on my thumb right before going into Ruby, but it was localized and small enough, light enough, mild enough that I didn't have a reason to drop. I talked to a physician twice and she was like, if you were to come off the trail, all we'd tell you is to wait and see what happens, right? So, okay, frostbitten, don't have a reason to drop. I'm tired. This is hard. What did I think going into the race? Of course it was going to be hard. Of course I'm going to be tired. So yeah, in some ways it was just a matter of doing what I set out to do.
And that's something that I'm sure, out of a week later, like, you can be super proud of. Like, honestly, just the resilience and the just like stick-to-itiveness that you have to have to do something for that long. So,
In some ways, I tried to never think about the entirety of the race because I was just too big. And it was every individual day. Can I get out there right now and put my skis on and go and do another however many miles, 2.5 miles for the next hour and then another 2.5 miles? And actually, there were a couple of times where the answer was no. There was one time along the Yukon where I'd done a 50-mile day and I had gotten a good night's sleep, but I'd had a huge breakfast and I was supposed to push out for another 50-mile day. And I started skiing and I turned around after half a mile because I was just feeling so off and so bad. I was like, there's no way I'm doing 50 miles today. So I came back and took another rest day, right? Burning through yet another buffer day. And I learned from that experience and had another situation like that on the coast where I had a huge breakfast kind of way too close to skiing. And I was so full, which is a good thing, right? Because you have to replenish calories, but I was so full that I couldn't even bend over to lace up my shoes. And I was like, I'm not even going to try right now. Rather than trying to force myself, which didn't work the last time, I'm going to lay on the couch and nap for an hour. And then I'm going to go and lace up my shoes and go.
That's awesome. I mean, it's just you now get to, I'm sure it'll hit you at some point of like the massiveness, 'cause I'm sure you have to keep it day by day. You have to keep it point by point, goal by goal, whatever your goal, like, if your goal is like 4 miles, I'll eat this Snickers bar or whatever, like, you have to keep it that way. Snickers are the best candy bars. It's obvious. But you have to keep it that way in your mind in the moment. But at some point, it's just going to hit you that you just did this massive thing. thing. Like maybe you'll look at a map of Alaska and just be like, holy moly, or something like that.
I did do that once or twice, and I'm like, yeah, that was a fun way.
But yeah, I'm just, you should be so proud, and it's absolutely incredible. And I'm honored to even be able to sit here and hear your story. So thank you. Thank you for coming on. Anything else you want to add before we like wrap this up?
The one thing I'd say is that, you know, it's really easy to get fixated kind of on the adventure and on the physical effort that it took to do something like this. And in some ways, I actually think that the physical part is the easiest by far. You know, if you're an ultra marathoner, if you can do 2 or 3 consecutive 30-mile days, chances are you can train up to do, you know, the distances that you need to do in Alaska. I think, you know, what made this adventure really hard was the mental part, you know, it was the commitment, it was the every day, you know, you just finished a really hard day and now tomorrow you're going to do it all over again, and you're going to do that for 30 days without stopping. So I'm excited that I was able to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And now you have that with you. Now you're like, I know I can do that now. So that's really cool. Where can people kind of follow along? Obviously your adventures in your soul, like you're going to go on more adventures in the future at some point when you're all recovered and whatnot. Where can people kind of follow along?
I am planning to go on more adventures. I'm scheduled to go to Denali in a couple of weeks. So, you know, I'm going to be back up in Alaska.
You're back up there.
Exactly. But yeah, you can find me on social media. I tend to be pretty active on Instagram and I do have connectivity and I'm out on adventures. My parents tried to make it difficult. So my name is not easy to spell, but it is the first initial last name. And that is Strooer.
Awesome.
Sunny Strooer. And then you can also find me by Googling, you know, woman to ski Iditarod Trail. You'll find the results. You'll find my website, sunnystrooer.com. And yeah.
That's amazing. Awesome. Well, Sunny, thank you for coming on. And I would be honored to have you back on in the future and hear all your amazing adventures.
Well, thank you, Chris. I love your podcast. Love being a guest on the show. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Like a Bigfoot podcast. Thank you all for joining. I really appreciate it. Hope you all found as much inspiration and motivation and you can tell Sunny's so passionate about just getting out there and trying something really hard and figuring out what you can learn from it, whether what you're learning is about, like, you know, some of the logistical things about adventure, or what do you learn about yourself? You know, when you're blowing across ice and the wind is knocking you every which direction and eventually you come to a screeching halt and you have to get up and you have to decide, what do I do next? You know, what can I do? What are my options in this moment? And I think that's a moment that, you know, maybe not that extreme. That seems really extreme and super scary. Don't find yourself in that situation if possible. But like, it's the situations like that where you kind of get knocked on your butt a little bit. Those are the situations where you're going to learn a lot, and you're going to learn a lot about your spirit, and you're going to learn a lot about kind of the human condition in those moments. And I just got done interviewing Sunny and I'm recording the outro right now, and I'm just like ready to take on the world, honestly. So once again, absolutely huge congratulations to Sunny. She was the first woman ever to ski the 1,000-mile Iditarod. That is a huge, huge accomplishment. I hope she's incredibly, incredibly, incredibly proud of herself for what she's been able to do, because holy moly, that is something that stuff ripples, you know? Just hearing Sunny talk and share the stories, that's how these ripple effects happen. And that's the thing that inspires other folks to do big things with their lives or to just experience their own life to the fullest. So thank you, Sunny, for coming on. Would love to chat with you in the future. I know you're going to do some amazing things. And yeah, would love to kind of hear more about your adventures. If you're out there listening, thank you. I hope you all are out chasing your own adventures. This was the first like 75 degree day out here in Colorado, and I have to say it got me ready to go for summer adventures and summer plans. Like, I'm just ready to be out on a trail, just running, covered in dirt and covered in mud and sweat, and seeing beautiful mountains and wilderness. So that's my plan. And yeah, hope you're out there planning good stuff too. All right, we will get back at you all next week. Thanks for coming.